So, we start again. My name is Anna Parkinson from Brazil, so I'm not really here. Thanks for the invitation. Let's start the second panel. That's about the WHO, and the post-Bali work plan. So, after the introduction, let's try to give a good idea, good hints. So how we can go move further. I'd like to start inviting Professor Mustafizur Rahman, from the Center of Policy Studies in Bangladesh. Mr. Mustafizur, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. First of all, let me register my deep appreciation and gratitude for this opportunity to share some of my thoughts on an issue which I think is very important for developing countries, particularly for the least developing countries. And I would like to also thank University of Intention Business and Economics for hosting us and for all the generosity that you have extended to me and my colleagues. I think we had a very good start this morning. And I'd like to begin by recalling what Ambassador Soon has said, that he reminded us that Doha Round is a development round, and without addressing the concerns of the developing countries, Doha Round can't have a balanced outcome. Out of 161 members of the WTO, about a fourth are least developed countries, and we have discussed many of the concerns and interests of the LDCs when we had our round table in Dhaka, which Dick was also mentioning. I think that what I will do is that I will try to share with you some of the views which the least developed countries would like to put forward in the context of the post-Bali work agenda. As we know that in Bali, the ministers decided that there will be a work plan by the end of December 2014, and we are still struggling with that. The new deadline is July 2015, and some of the discussions are going on. But I will try to situate my discussion in the context of coherence that we must ensure in view of the post-Bali work program. Now we are now discussing the SDGs. If you look at the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals and the 17 Goals and 169 Targets, you'll see that a large number of those goals and targets talk about how to make multilateral trading system work for achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. If we think about the Istanbul Program of Action for the LDCs, it says that trade should be a major driver of achieving the ambition of halving the number of LDCs from 48 to 24 by 2021. If we look at the zero draft for the fifth global review of aid for trade, which will take place on 30th June and 2nd July this year, you will see that trade is perceived to be a major driver of development of the developing countries, particularly the LDCs. And if you look at the means of implementation meeting that will take place in Addis Ababa in July, there also we see that there is a strong commitment on the part of the global community to make trade work for the development of the developing countries. Now, if we take that in the context, and if we are mindful of that, then the whole issue of the discourse with regards to the post-Bali work program takes a different view. Maybe there are concerns of USA, United, and the EU and the emerging countries, but if we take the interest of the most weak economies of the world, then obviously the target should be set to remember the developmentness of the Doha Development Round and to bound it up in a manner that addresses the ambition of which the round really started. From that perspective, I think it is very important that the work program addresses and takes forward the LDC package that was agreed in Bali. If we take some of the major issues which should be included in the work program, I think the duty-free quota fee issue, which is of critical importance to the least developed countries. In the work program, I think that there should be a clear-cut ambition with regards to the inclusion of the 3% exclusion list, which is there. And also, there should be an agreement that the lists of the duty-free quota fee items should be put forward upfront by the developed country. And also, I think that the work program should include because the Hong Kong decision with regard to the duty-free quota fee mentioned that developed countries and developing countries in a position to do so. And I think the emerging countries like China and India and Brazil have to be also ambitious with regards to according duty-free quota fee to all products originating from all LDCs. So I think that, yes, China and India have come up with generous offer, but I think that the Hong Kong decision also obligates the emerging countries to come up with more ambition with regard to that. I think the work program should also be very clear cut with regard to following up with regard to the services waiver, which was agreed in Bali. These developed countries have already submitted their request, as was asked. Nepal, on behalf of their LDCs, have already submitted. In February 2015, in the first week, there was a conference, high-level conference, where the 24 developed countries also have come up with their offer list. I think the work program now should include the modalities of reconciling the offer and the request of LDCs and the developed countries, and the regulations that we need to be undertaken in the developed countries in order to accord the services waiver in the sectors of interest to the LDCs. So I think that should be also in the work program. With regards to the SND clauses, there was in Bali, there was an agreement that there will be a monitoring mechanism with regard to the SND clauses. SND clauses are an integral part of the WTO. They cannot be just perceived to be something which is being offered out of sympathy. I think they are, and it has been also mentioned in the zero draft of the fifth global review of aid for trade that SNDs are integral to the WTO, and Professor Stiglitz and others have come up with ideas also that whether the DSP mechanism can also be put into effect if the SNDs are not complied with. So I think that in light of what has been agreed in Bali, the monitoring mechanism and its modalities should be further and in a transparent way should be spelled out in the course of the work program, in the course of Bali work program in Geneva. With regard to the preferential rules of origin also, there are a lot of concerns with regard to that. Although market access is there under the duty-free quota fee, but if we really would like to attain the ambition of enhanced market access, a commercially meaningful market access, as has been mentioned in the WTO, then obviously the rules of origin and preferential rules of origin will have to be spelled out in a manner which really allows the agencies to access the markets of the developed and advanced developing countries in a meaningful manner. In the Bali, the decision with regards to trade facilitation was very critical, as was also mentioned in the morning that in 1996, when the post-Singapore issues came up, developing countries, and particularly this is very much against inclusion, but after about 20 years, it's now a part of the WTO. So in the work program, what NDC is wanting is that there should be clear-cut commitment with regard to the Category C projects, which was mentioned. It is good that for the first time it is mentioned that that compliance with the trade facilitation agreement by the NDC will be subjected, will be contingent upon commensurate financial and technical assistance from the developed countries. So I think that that should be given more transparency in the work program, so that the Category C projects for which LDCs are wanting to have technical and financial assistance are there. With regards to the aid for trade, we are hoping that the fifth global review of aid for trade in June will come up with concrete suggestions and the commitment of 0.7% of the national income of the developed countries to be accorded to aid, and out of that 0.15 or 0.2% to be accorded to the LDCs. We are hoping that there will be concrete decision with regard to that as well. I think that, and it was also discussed in the Dhaka roundtable, and we hope that the plurilaterals, which also was also mentioned in the morning, obviously we have concerns with regard to both the plurilaterals and the mega banker blocks, that weaker economies like the LDCs, we have a lot of difficulty to comply with many of the stringent rules which will be negotiated in the mega bloc, even though these will later may come as open regional development countries may be open to joining them, but we think that the rules which are being set will be more stringent, and there will be, as was mentioned, there will be investment diversion as well. So we think that in the context of the post-Bali work plan, there should be initiatives in support of the LDCs to build up their capacities to participate in the value chains, to attract investment, and also at some stage, if there is an opportunity to also join some of the mega blocks. I will give you just one example. For example, one of our Bangladesh's major competitor in apparels is Vietnam. And Vietnam is not an LDC, it's a developing country. Now, if as part of the TPP, Vietnam gets zero tariff in the US market, and the US market, the apparel tariff is about 15%. So, it may end up in a situation where an LDC like Bangladesh will pay 15% of tariff, and Vietnam, a major competitor and a developing country, not an LDC, will get zero tariff action. So all these will have important implications for the competitiveness regime in which we will have to work. So the post-Bali, I think, work plan will have to take these concerns so that there is a balanced outcome, as Ambassador has mentioned, particularly for the LDCs. And in order to do that also, we also have to keep a sharp eye on what is taking place in Nama and agriculture. Now, there are different perspectives even among the LDCs with regard to how to look at Nama and agriculture. But I would agree with Ambassador Sun when he says that the texts which are there and which were before 2008 could be starting points for continuing the negotiations. But on the other hand, there are concerns because if the Nama negotiations go on according to the Swiss formula, etc., there will be severe preference erosion on the part of the developed LDCs, which get zero tariff access in most of the developed countries. So this serious preference erosion, there has to be some balancing, perhaps see more 8-foot tree and more 8-foot tree facilitation. On the other hand, for agriculture also, open this liberalization and agriculture in whatever manner, whether the current text or any new text, and there are a lot of concerns because our 42 LDCs out of 48, they are net food importing countries. So there will be major repercussions over there. With regard to the public stockholding, obviously we have articulated our concern as well. Many of the LDCs have offensive interests, many of them have defensive interests with regard to that. What will happen to the global prices, what will happen, whether there will be dumping in the international market. And so there, that concern is also remains. So I think that overall, the LDCs would like to have faith in the multilateral trading system, because we think that a rule-based, transparent multilateral trading system is good for the weaker economy. It gives us predictability, it gives us opportunities for non-reciprocal benefits, and but we think that the work plan which is being now negotiated should reflect the particular concerns of the LDCs. Most of the LDCs are now pursuing trade liberalization, open market policies, but they are also becoming vulnerable in the context of the regional and the global value chain, supply chain, more competition. So, but at the same time, they also understand that trade could be a major driver of their development. My own country, Bangladesh, has benefited tremendously from global trade. In an economy of $160 billion, our trade is about $75 billion. At least more, and the degree of openness is increasing. We are the second largest exporter of apparels after China in the world. So we understand the benefits of trade. But at the same time, we also understand that there has to be, trade cannot be free if it is not fair. And that fairness has to be reflected in the post-body work program. So,
with those words,
I'd like
to conclude. Thank you for your attention. Thank you very much. Let's move to the second speaker, to be Professor
Jin Cheng
from Lunkei University.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. First, I'd like to thank the sponsor and the China Institute of Development Studies and IIA inviting to this roundtable. I think that the topic of the session is very important, very timely, because the two members are on the way to figure out the post-body work plan, and also they are on the way to conclude the Durham Round as collected. Of course, it's very holistic scenario. First, I would like to have some comments on the current progress of the WTO Doha Round negotiations, and then I'll try to provide some policy recommendations. Firstly, I think the ambition of the Doha Round negotiation has been much lower after several setbacks and the voting process. As Ambassador Sun mentioned this morning, four Singapore issues were substantially dropped out of the DA agenda, except the trade facilitation. The current negotiation has retreated to three traditional areas or topics, agriculture, NAMA, and services. In terms of the trade agenda, there seems to be nothing brand new in the Doha Round negotiation. If it cannot be concluded or achieved a breakthrough outcome expected in the 10th Ministerial Conference held at the end of this year in Nairobi, Kenya, the deal, I think, will be upon board once again. and we'll perceive that more negotiating resources will be shifted to the collaborating RTAs or FTAs. Thus, the central role of the WTO in the global treatment system will be further debated. Second, although it's really relevant for 2013 budget agreement, which is called early harvest, to resume momentum after our round negotiation, we could not overestimate the significance of achievement. For instance, a number of the trade facilitation measures have already been implemented in advanced countries and many emerging economies. The trade facilitation agreement only locked in committing to taking such measures. Another example is that the body agreement only requests the members to exercise at most restraint with regard to any resources to all forms of export subsidies and all export measures with equivalent effect. There is not any substantial quantitative regulations on such essential agricultural issues. The main key elements in the budget agreement were actually unsolved and postponed to the next round of the negotiation. So, like what Professor Richard Baldwin said, the budget agreement actually is a ribbon of agreement rather than a package of agreement. Third, the main task of the post-body work plan is seeking an effective solution to the unsolved issues in the 2013 WTO negotiation at Bali. To work out the post-body work plan, it seems that at this moment, negotiating members return to 2008 draft package of the key issues. The biggest triumph is the Trade Participation Agreement, which was recently passed by the General Council, and it became the first multilateral treaty since the WTO was founded in 1995. With respect to the tariff reduction of agriculture and non-agricultural products, members are still vigorously debating on the formula. Firstly, which formula should be taken and how the crucial parameters in the formula should be set. It is more challenging for reducing domestic support in agricultural production due to the accuracy of the data, new defensive interests of agricultural policy, like the United States, and a special safeguard in developing members. And these remaining difficulties actually are almost old bitter ones 7 years ago. Given the fact, I have some recommendations of the post-body work plan. First, find an aggregate and balanced compromise among the different topics instead of in the individual topic. The success of the work plan demands a more well-organized, multi-tier negotiation and a more rational and pragmatic inter-topic and inter-topic interest exchanges. Second, combining the built-in formal approach with a new proposed request and offer process in agriculture and NAMA negotiations. The objective of the formal approach is to ensure a minimum level of the market access, where the request and offer approach is to reach a maximum level of market liberalization based on the mutual benefits. Third, encouraging plurilateral agreement or critical mass approach in the WTO. Four plurilateral agreements, TISA, IPA2, EPA, and EPA, provide us enlightening cases of how to promote negotiation in some emerging areas, which will benefit most important trading nations. Fourth, using peace calls in some harsh debated and deadlocked topics. The lesson is drawn from the dispute on the public stock holding for food security purpose between the United States and India. In this way, the confrontation may be put aside until a permanent solution could be found in the future, so as not to impede the whole proceeding of the negotiation. Finally, seriously examine all issues and processes related to trade and development. Special and preferential treatment should be clearly and comprehensively set in agreement in horizontal and vertical level. In horizontal level, there should be general principles and measures of special and treatment for LDCs, small and vulnerable economies. In the horizontal level, it should include a variety of special and counter issues, such as aid for trade and transfer of technology, preferential rules of origin for LDCs, preferential treatment for services, duty-free and cost-free market access for LDCs, and so on. And all these elements should truly reflect the nature of Doha Round negotiation around to promote development in the developing countries. As well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Our third speaker will be Mr. Tomoshika Yuma, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Japan.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me for this very important seminar. I'm glad that I was able to participate. And although I'm coming from the Japanese Foreign Ministry, given the situation here, perhaps I should not represent the government of Japan. So whatever I say is not necessarily the official position of the Japanese government. In particular, since Mr. Lu and some others, Ambassador Sun, was in Geneva quite a number of years, so I'm clearly biased to pro-WTO. So that's to say at the beginning. And I think there are many speakers who referred to the RTAs, the regionals, and so forth, PPPs, and that's right, and in Japan as well, the resources are devoted for those negotiations. Not necessarily as much as to the WTO. But however, I have to first of all stress that the WTO is still considered, not just by Japan, but for others, as a very useful tool for to ensure the expansion of trade. Recently, I participated in the Japan's trade policy review, which we have to conduct every 2 years for Japan. And I led the delegation, and we have received something like 700 questions, the written questions. I have to answer all of them. And this shows how each of the countries, members, are still interested in using WTO mechanism. And in the fall, we have more than 40 countries raised the floor, and some came from Latin America and also from African countries. And they were very struck by the fact that the many African capitals instructed the delegation in Geneva to raise some questions or comments to the Japan PPR. So that's very participatory process. I was very much impressed. And but nevertheless, we share concern that the negotiation function of the WTO is not very active, and Doha round is not promising, and the, in particular after the 2008 Ministry of Meeting. And the problem is, first of all, although it's been actually used, including the dispute settlements, and the, but the rule of law is really this part of a multilateral training system. So, but the rulemaking process and application rules now having a gap. If this expands too much, maybe the dispute settlement mechanism is weakened in the future. If something is done to the rulemaking process. And secondly, as my previous speakers already mentioned, there are many new type of trade is emerging in the global value chains, and the new issues are coming up, and the WTO is not really responding to those questions. It's really striking for me that there's no functioning in the WTO dealing with investment, for example. I'm not just not talking about investment negotiations, but there's no study or even activities in investment in WTO. There's no single person in the WTO secretariat dealing with investment. So can this kind of organization be relevant to the modern global trading system? That's the question. And the third, if there is more and more RTAs making progress on liberalization of trade, and that itself may be good for those participating in it, but there are quite many, particularly small developing countries, who are left out. And the, so there is free trade among RTA participants, while small islands, vulnerable economies, are still facing to develop countries. This kind of poses the question of WTO or the global trading system, a question of balance or in terms of development. So I think in this situation, I think it's very important to conclude the Doha round, to implement post-value growth program, and the, as soon as possible. But the challenge is like I said, so many attention being paid to the RTAs, and the situation is very different from 2008 ministerial negotiations. There are a lot of efforts now being done in Geneva. How we can realistically bring this Doha come to an end. And this is quite challenging and different kind of challenge maybe we are facing several years ago. And the, so what is what is good was, like I said, trade facilitation. So first of all, it's very important for us to make trade facilitation be an integral force. Hopefully by the end of the year, and we are sort of completing our administrative procedures. Now it's we propose to the Parliament to consider, and hopefully we'll be able to get the approval from our Parliament, hopefully before summer. And the the challenge is how realistically we can promote. And the, as you know, what is being discussed in Geneva, in particular how we should deal with these three main market access issues, agriculture and urban services, and how to set a level of vision which is doable. So this is the key word right now. And so we are facing the challenge of how to make a post-buy work program by the end of July. Actually, we don't have much time, and but the discussion seems not going as fast as necessary. So I think think it's very useful to, important for members to think about the reality and how best we can conclude in a more flexible manner. And the, but what is encouraging, there are some new ideas coming up from certain countries like Argentina, Paraguay, and ACP countries. And those, all those proposals have some significance in that it's a kind of departure from our thinking of 2008 text. And if we stick to what the situation, 2008 situations, I think it's not very possible to come to a conclusion. And how to make our exercise a bit more simpler and come to an agreement without speaking too much into the detailed issues of the 2008 text. Is, I think, it's a critical right now. And the discussions should not be just a very, should be more sort of focused on some numbers in a more concrete way, so that each of us know what we want, what we can offer, and what can be concluded. So I think that is necessary, and the like others said, high-level meeting, the ministerial meeting, and in the margins of OECD ministerial or G20, the trade ministers meeting, and some others should be utilized to increase the attention of ministers. Aside from the post-Bible program, it's also maybe useful to continue the bilateral negotiations. I think there's some misunderstanding that the plurilateral negotiation is an opposite side of the multilateral negotiations. Actually, there has been a traditional WTO, or even to the GATT era, plurilateral was a kind of the main way of negotiating the multilateral negotiations. If you look at the WTO experience, negotiations like ITA, Basic Telephones Agreement, the financial services agreement were all concluded on the plurilateral negotiations, but applied on an American basis to all the WTO members. So actually, plurilateral negotiations have been strengthening the WTO in rulemaking or market access process. So there should be also exploration must be made to whether we can do it for the rulemaking process in a plurilateral manner, in a flexible manner, in terms of participation, but when applied on an MFM basis. I think there are some exploration on that basis for the trade facilitation, but fortunately, we were able to make a multilateral agreement, but those could be explored in the future. With that to the question of emerging economies like China, India, I think this is quite key to conclude the Doha round. If you look at the GATT article 36, there are some sentences like, given the continued dependence of many less developed and contracting parties on the exploitation of a limited range of primary products, there is a need to provide, in the largest possible measure, more favorable and acceptable conditions to access the world market for those products, and well appropriate to devise measures designed to stabilize and improve conditions of world markets in those in these products. I think that those days, developing countries have been considered an exploitation of only a limited range of primary products. And it was never thought about developing countries creating TVs, automobiles, those manufacturing and the export those products. So I think we have to change our mind. We have to depart from traditional developing countries and their economy, but more sort of recognize the existing trading are the benefits each of the country gets. There are certain responsibilities that they offers to make a global trading system work, including the mobility global hub. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Now I think you have more than 1 hour to start the discussion. So I'd like to raise some points to a little bit of warm discussion. Let's put the things like the mentor Zoom talk a very important point that we are not talking about more on a pure W2 issues. We are talking about and W2 plus against the plurilaterals or mega regional, but you are talking about geoeconomics. And I fully agree that this is the new point in the discussion. We cannot discuss any more W2 without putting in front of us that the world changed a lot after 2008. Right? What do you, in my sense, is changing? We are not finished with the financial crisis, not yet. Not yet when you have Swiss issue bonds in with negative values and the market accepting it. It's amazing. Yesterday I was reading the newspaper that Switzerland issue bonds and they completely were accepted by the market. So can you imagine you are paying for some bank to take care of your money? So what's the meaning of this? That you have a huge amount of money around the world that nobody knows how to do with it. So it's not true that the financial crisis is over. I think it is in its own beginning, right? The new. But you have another point that is the funny or the second funny thing is that the U.S., despite all the quantitative easing, now has the interest rate, the exchange rate that is being overvalued. It's fantastic against the world that is undervalued. I'll talk a little bit about this tomorrow. So the opposite way, the U.S., despite all the efforts, is getting overvaluation on this. You have more than this. You have the race of China. That is amazing. China is not, I'm talking as a Brazilian, right? During the round, when I was in Geneva, China is a very, very quiet member, in the sense that it's not really aggressive one. What you have, can you imagine that, and we listen about what China was doing in Africa. Do you have any idea what is China is doing in South America? I can tell you. I was in 2 weeks ago in the Cartagena meeting about the Pacific Alliance. They are a group of four Spanish countries discussing their own integration process. Inside a lot of many preferential arrangements that we have in South America. The funny thing about this is the huge amount of interest of China's people there. We have ministers, we have a lot of people there, and from Korea also. So what China and Korea and Japan was doing in Cartagena in Colombia. So what is new about this? And the whole integration. I try to discover this. It's a huge interest on infrastructure. It is a huge interest on bring this part of the world to be engaged in the Pacific Alliance and so on, is that, in my view, another way to play with bringing some other countries to the region that was being dominated by the U.S. Again, geoeconomics, right? So this is the thing, the new thing. The other point is China trying to develop financial centers to have the renminbi as an international unit, in the sense that you know about the special drawing rights, and for the ones that are following the discussion of finance now, there's a new discussion to revive the special drawing rights. where you have only four currencies, and now certainly China must be the further 51. So what is the interest of, why does the reason China is giving so many swaps? You heard about that, the huge amount of money that that China is lending to Brazil now because of the oil problem, for to Argentina and for all countries in Latin America. It's a huge amount of money going on around this. So these are the new things. The infrastructure bank, the new infrastructure bank, that I think by that United States will be the only one out of the bank, Japan. So I'd like to ask Japan if they're going to be out of not. But the BRICS bank, and so come on, what's this? There's a huge amount of ones, right, that the creating banks. This is new. And we cannot talk about the old style discussion of WTO without putting this behind our minds, right? WTO is not the same anymore. Okay, going back to the WTO. My question is, and with this I finish. There is any other way that we can introduce the challenging issues that we have in face of us? That is global value chains, the mega agreements, investment. I agree with you. It's a ridiculous not to discuss investment, competition, and all these big issues in the WTO. There is any way to put this inside the house, discussing it without negotiation? So that's just to warm the discussion, to put people aware that things are going on. I'm following a lot about the what's going on the financial area, what's the stability board discussion and all of this in Bern and so on. My point is, in Basel, sorry. And the question is, how cannot we discuss this in Geneva? One thing is discussed, the other thing is negotiate. But negotiating without bringing these issues to the mind of the negotiators, I think that it's a huge error, right? So I fully agree that we have to go to plurilaterals, we have to go to the to decide the way we are trying to finish this. But again, only dealing with old issues, I don't think it's going to satisfy them. So with this, I start this discussion section. Asking who will be the first. Please think.
Could I ask a question of Mr. Uyama? You are, your country is involved, of course, in all of the WTO post-Bali program discussions. But you're also negotiating both bilaterally and plurilaterally in the TPP. How do you see the relationship between those two lines of negotiation?
Thank you very much. First, if we talk about media attention, in terms of media attention, for example, all the media is talking about TPP. And almost nothing is said about WTO, post-Trump. But that's the situation. But in the government, since I'm particularly looking at WTO myself, we see the role of both of them, of course. And the, also, RT is not just TV, but there are a lot of, maybe 7 or 8 or maybe more, bilateral or plurilateral RT negotiations that are ongoing in a parallel fashion. And those, we think those are kind of, making progress on trade liberalization, and that also help our internal domestic reforms by participating in the negotiations. The WTO is a kind of a backbone of the trading system. So we also think it's important to keep the WTO relevant, and for the basic rulemaking and field liberalization process, and also refugee settlement mechanism. We see WTO as a backbone, and the old RTAs are kind of parts of that global trading system that constitute the overall global trading system. And the TPP is a bit sort of unique in the sense it's slightly different from other RTAs. It's quite a good number of participants, and it's been quite large resources being devoted, political resources. So it's been sort of paid more attention to by press, press, but also at the political level. So we don't think it's those are contradict each other, but it's it should be done on the parallel question.
Please.
Yeah, I would like to follow the Professor Cunningham to have a specific question to Mr. Yang. would you please let us know something, the general position of the Japanese government in agriculture negotiation in comparison with your offer, a possible offer in the EPP?
Well, I think first of all, I'm not part of the EPP, so I don't know what it should be. And actually, if I knew, I would not be the same thing about that. So in any case, it's quite difficult to make comments on the specifics. And what I can say is, although Japan is an agriculture, we have a higher tariff, and we also have a domestic support. But we also are in the process of reform. And if you talk about Abenomics, Mr. Abe's major reform, agriculture is one of the pillars of such reforms. And the new bill is now proposed to the parliament to make fundamental reform to the Japanese agriculture associations. And this is ongoing. And also agriculture is part of the trade negotiations, not just in WTO, but also in RTA, including the TPP. And devote ourselves to make efforts to successful conclusion to the negotiations. So this is where we are. And WTO and TPP are separate, in fact. So I think there is no official link between them. But the agricultural reform happening in Japan, those go to the same direction, make our agriculture more competitive and make more liberalization process. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, I enjoyed very much this morning discussion because it has been so comprehensive, touched upon almost every aspect of the negotiation. As quite some of you know, I just came back from Geneva. So I just came back from Geneva and I just left my official post, German official. So I'm still in between, I'm still in my transition period. But just to take advantage of my particular kind of situation, I would like to make a few comments and also in a way try to answer some of the questions you have posed. I think a few things here we need to look at. First is how do we conclude the body, post by the Doha, including implementation of the post body as well as the the how do we do the post-bilingual program, and secondly, how do we look beyond the Doha, so we, to look at kind of perspective for post-Doha, and considering both how do we tackle those issues which potentially we could not conclude in Nairobi, and how do we deal with those new issues which are of course important to the system. And then, of course, about how do we deal the things not through immediate negotiation but through discussion. The first thing about how do we conclude the Doha, I think I'll start with this more or less psychological issue about the label of the Doha as a development bond. The thing is that we have heard a lot from not only the US but quite some others about this change of the world, change of the situation, rise of the emerging economy, so on and so forth. So people are saying that instead of a development round, which was quite correct, the development deficit, instead we are going to do the horse trading. I think that, that's quite dangerous. I mean, if you really want to conclude the Doha, because it's like for the past 15 years we've been building a house, and the foundation is that is a development bond. And if you change that, and then the foundation is gone, and then you have to either just tear down the whole house or start from scratch. So I think that's something we need to be careful, especially when you say that horse trading is equal. You give me a stud, I give you $10, like that. And then that changes also when another principle we have said from the very beginning, this lesson for reciprocity principle. But of course, having said that, I do not mean that we should stick to this kind of old philosophy of special differential treatment. I think yesterday someone has said that the TFA, the Section 2, has offered a new kind of thinking, a mindset about how to deal with kind of special and differential treatment. Instead of giving a kind of stereotyped special differential treatment for everyone, it says that that you're not there yet, and we're going to help you to achieve that. And then one day, when you are there, and you have to fully comply with it. So I think that probably is also a thinking. So we have to look at everything in a pragmatic manner, including special differential treatment. About the another aspect of how to conclude Doha is that. Right now, from what I'm reading here on the discussion in Geneva, people seem to be kind of concentrated more on the core issues, which are including the three ag, NAMA, services, and development. I think it's pragmatic. I think that's the natural way we should further pursue. Of course, on development, there may be a word of advice to Ms. Rahman, is that many things you have mentioned about the concerns of LDCs. For me, I think that when we say we want to realistically and pragmatically look at everything, that also includes on LDCs. The thing, let me give you two examples. One example is about monitoring mechanism, because I was heading in charge of division negotiating on all LDC issues, including monitoring mechanism. One example is that one key issue in the monitoring mechanism is how many meetings do we do every year. And from in the very beginning, LDC says that as necessary. And then some developed countries, including the US, say that no, not more than one. And then we come down to something like one, if necessary, another one. But after that, after Bali, we have had, I think, at least before I left Geneva, twice, a meeting on a monitoring mechanism. There's zero inputs from LDC. So that's a pity, I mean.
So this is an example, which I mean, I do not mean you are wrong to ask for more meetings, but I think that you need to be fully prepared. How do you use that? You don't want to ask for something which you are not able to use. Another example is about this full DFEQL and to eliminate again the 3%. The thing is that I know that 97% is important. China was the first to announce that that will give 97% to meetings. Of course, people are asking for another 3% from all major players. But I remember in the very beginning, because when China first, I think it was only something like 200 or 300 pipelines for ADCs that already covers something like 95 to 98% of all ADC exports to China. So which I mean that 100% doesn't really mean 100%. Probably 200 would cover most of your exports. So instead of asking for 100%, probably another way to look at this is that try to scale down your demands by focusing really on those you can export or potentially you can export in the near future. So I think that probably will also give some political scope for the defenders back at home. So those are the things I think will be important for the future. The same thing is about how do we look beyond Doha. The thing is that those issues which we cannot, other than the three core issues together with development, there are many other things which we have done a very good job. I mean, those things could be, we have used this in work, right? Why don't we just do a building agenda? I kind of try to carry on discussion on these issues in the future. But let's finish the Doha and then go further. This actually brings me to answer your question about not only those built-in agenda, old items, but also new issues. In Geneva, we have discussed a lot about how do we strengthen the regular meetings instead of negotiation meetings, and how do we use more the sectoral people with more studies, more papers, even more recommendation. There are different views, but I think it will be wise to do this. I mean that at least some of those new issues, we could bring them into the WTO regular bodies. If there is no regular body like investment, I think we could easily establish a working group on that and then try to help discuss without negotiating first. Because credit facilitation is an excellent example to show that when we developed countries say no in Singapore, and now we accept it and we're going to implement it. What has happened is simply because through these years, we have learned through the kind of various kind of information sharing, more kind of education, and we see through our own practice that's how credit facilitation is going to help. So I think that's also something we should do. Education, discussion, and then negotiation. That's a kind of three-step thing forward. About emerging economies, I think that making political by saying that you're bigger, you should do more, and then why don't we just forget about that? Why don't we concentrate on these? And let's say that how about non-NAMA and see where something I think you should do more, and probably you are ready to do more. And then they discuss, instead of saying that, well, putting too many political labels on emerging economies and try to do it in a pragmatic manner. But on the other hand, I think that emerging countries, when you ask them for more, and they are in for demanders like developed countries, you should be ready to give more, like the type of things that have been discussed and some other things. So I will just stop here.
Good. Thank you very much. Please,
Mr. Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Mr. Luke, for your very helpful comments with regard to the two issues that we have I fully agree that there is capacity deficit in fact in the ABC. But even when there is capacity, you know, our representatives in Geneva oftentimes do not do justice to what our demands are. Particularly, we have also seen the tug of war between the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Commerce, because the negotiations are done by the Foreign Ministry of officials, but the real issue that they have to be by the Minister of Commerce. So there is also a problem with that. But I agree that the ABC should have come up with proposals, because, for example, at the the think tank levels, as I say, there has been a number of proposals with regard to how to make the monitoring mechanism more effective, ending with whether to introduce a provision that if it is not complied with, then you can take it to dispute settlement body. Even that, at that level, the discussion has been there. But unfortunately, we were not able to submit any concrete proposals. And in the WTO, as we know, you get not what you deserve, but what you negotiate. With regard to the point, duty-free quota fee, now, I was part of the government delegation in 2005 when in Hong Kong the duty-free quota fee was being negotiated. And when we saw that that some countries were not ready to concede that it should be 100% for all items from all embassies, and they were insisting that it should be a certain percentage of tariff lines, we could see that even 97% of the tariff lines could include 0% of export. So what we proposed on that night, and we were negotiating five o'clock in the morning, that let us put also along with the percentage of tariff lines, a percentage of value term. So 97% of the tariff lines, which will include 90% of export value. So that was what we proposed. But United States was extremely against it, because we did the calculation on that night that for example, from Bangladesh perspective, that US imports about 11,000 items at the tariff line level, AD. So 93% exclusion will leave 330 items. And they can include all the ready-made garments, even at 8-digit level from Bangladesh. So theoretically it is possible that 97% of market access in the United States will have 0% in value terms, because you can exclude 330 items and that will not. So we had tried that, but unfortunately it was not accepted. So what we have done from Hong Kong to Bali is that we wanted to have that this market access decision will be implemented in a commercially meaningful way, in an enhanced market access, market way. So those words were given, but we were not really able to put any percentage in terms of value terms. So that's how it is. Thank you.
Next, please.
Thank you, Mr.
Very interesting and stimulating discussions. For this panel, I would like to make some brief responses to Villa's comments. I think that is, we have affirmed a very important point, especially on the emerging economy and China. I think that is very, very important. People are talking about the changing context of the WTO. I'll focus on China. I think China, there have been tremendous changes in the Chinese economy after the global financial crisis of 2008. I see we have the good things and the bad things from the stimulation package. We talk about 4 trillion RMB. The following foreign crisis. That is a more popular concept in China about the Chinese economy, that is the new normal. A new normal of Chinese economy. What does that mean? That is, the government and the public have been prepared before the slower growth rate. And it now becomes 7 to 7.5% in a year. And you see, the big pressure is still restructuring the economy to the reduced dependence on the international economy. To turn the economy into a more domestic market, a driven one. That is a third thing. But in addition to that, we have also have a problem like the growing amount of the foreign exchange reserve. It's now about $4 trillion. And we relate to it. We also have a problem of over capacity. That is all the factors. The factors that put the China and have to figure out the new policy, the new solutions. Some of the Villa, you have mentioned that. Then the another background for the new policies we have in this so that we have discovered part of the international context. Okay, that is in people talking about the rising strategic competition between China and the United States, in the region, in the Asia Pacific, and the global affairs. There is a TPP. The TPP is a very hot topic in China as well. Even China is not part of this. Right? I understand that the public and the academics has reshaped its approach to TPP, from the more highly skeptical of intention, right? From the more neutral, more accommodating to this. So I think in the future, I think yes, as in China, it might be it can be a part of TPP, but maybe not this time. So now what's the result? The changing of domestic, the changing of the international context. And what kind of policy, one quick policy, that is the government assuming. So I think, generally speaking, there is one, is we are in a moment for the new round of opening up. I think that personally, I'm very clear about that. Okay, that comes from the changing from the pressure, domestic and international pressure. So I think the new leadership is very clear about that. So we'd like to repeat the successful story of the WTO accession in using the external pressure as to push forward the domestic reform agenda. That is, I think that is very clear about that. So we relate to this. Mentalist, we say China has carrying forward their multi-front, multi-lagged trade strategy. China is building its own, or our own, the network of the FTAs. I think that is when we look at China, China Korea, China Australia. And others, right? China also interested in the speeding up the negotiations with ASEAN, that is FTAs, right? And we have a lot of elements like that. So we have a whole pictures about this. Second thing, that is what the trade policy, what the trade implication of the Chinese new Silk Road Initiative. He named China called One Belt, One Road. Right? That is all about being popular. So please pay attention to this. So it's a very interesting thing. So the policy that it's not about the one as I understand the so called the one about one root. It's not about our holistic attitudes, right? That is us, it is, but it is something that is in nature. It is our, it is China's initiative on international economic operations. But about the somebody's duty would be positioning that the TPA or other higher standard trade financial arrangement will be considered regarding to the countries along the routes of the Silk Road. So I think that is going to be a very interesting development in this world as well. Thirdly, that is China is conducting important negotiations with the United States over BIT, a bilateral trade agreement. China-Europe, I think, will expect it to launch the BIT as well. And more than that. So and we expect that following the BIT agreements, so these three big economies of global in the world, China, US, and EU, that probably enter the talks of FTA. So maybe I'm a little bit optimistic about that. So and together we look at China's driven by domestic and international pressure. Right? So the China has pursued more aggressively or more assertive with the free trade agreement. And we also there's a lot of people here thinking the high standard is good too. It's good. So I think now we have some picture, more picture, the centered about the competitive liberalization. So that is where you talking about, you ask a question, what is its implications to WTO for the market peace? So I think maybe that's a new phase of the new but it definitely will produce profound implications to WTO. Maybe to the economic globalization. Maybe we are at the doorstep of a new round of economic globalization. And for this round, probably more depend on the emerging economy, especially China, as a major driver. Thank you.
Yes, please. Deborah, and then who's the first one? You go ahead. Okay.
I was just going to say that since I started the Asian Trade Center in August, we've been meeting with between 4 and 10 companies a week. Big companies, small companies, they're all interested in trade, or they would like to be interested in trade, so that's what unites them. So these are the folks that ought to be keenly aware and attuned to what's going on in Geneva. Not one country, I mean, I was the whole morning, I was thinking, not one company that I have talked to has mentioned the WTO. Not one. They haven't, not only, but it gets worse. It's not only that they haven't mentioned the WTO, but when they tell me what their issues are, I've been racking my brain all morning. I can't think of any of the issues that any of these companies have raised that is addressed in the WTO agenda. Wow, this is depressing as hell. Like, how in the world, I mean, they're just not interested. And if I say, well, you know, tariff cut, they're like, yeah, you know, even if we face tariffs in whatever my sector is, I don't think the WTO is going to solve my sector, my tariff issues. What my issues are is, you know, incompatible standards, which are creating problems for me, labeling requirements that I can't resolve, barriers on services, especially issues around investment. I can't get in. I can only get in with joint venture partners. I can't buy land. I can't find the right partners. It's a non-transparent atmosphere. I don't know what the government decisions will be. I struggle at the border because what classification of my goods changes from moment to moment and minute to minute. I mean, all of these are the things that companies are talking to me about as their struggle, and nowhere in there does the multilateral system appear to fit. Now, this is depressing for me because I can make, I think, some very good arguments for why it would be great for these companies in all of these issues if it were working. But I'd just like to note that, you know, the, at least the companies that I'm speaking to, and again, they don't all just come to me, we go out and find them. It's just, it's a totally different universe from what we're talking about this morning, and I think that is a problem. I'll just leave it at that. Dick?
Before I go to what I want to say, very important about what was said a moment ago, what you just heard is what the United States policymakers have been seeing for most of the Doha round, and why they have a major reason why they moved to other types of negotiations is that their constituency, their business constituency, is telling them, go deal with some other things. And that's why you have an agenda like you have a TPP, although TPP probably doesn't fit entirely with your people, but,
no, but
probably
it gets closer.
More.
It gets a lot closer, and so that's why companies
right.
are paying attention.
Right. I want to go back to the previous speaker, and let me just say, I think that was one of the most important things I've heard today, and one of the things I wanted to focus on the significance of it. When you have a situation in which there are between two parties a difference in viewpoint, a difference in policy, something that looks like we need to deal with that and do a negotiation and get one party to agree with the other party's viewpoint, almost always it's useful to sit back and say, hold on, we need to distinguish between those situations in which we really need to do between three things. One, those situations in which there's a current issue that has to be addressed now and we need to do a negotiation to resolve it. Two, there's a type of issue that is in flux that will be changing in the policy of one or both of the countries. And in a situation like that, maybe the thing to do is to have a dialogue, to try to have a sympathetic dialogue between the two countries, but not precipitate the issue until you think that it has to be precipitated because it's not going to be worked out by evolution. And as to China, but one of the things that it seems to me you have to think in your mind about China is that of all countries in the world that one could look at and say, that country is in the process of change and in evolution and moving in various respects from one policy to another policy in a various area, in a particular area. China has to be the quintessential example of that. And it's important for anybody deciding how to deal with some issues to think about whether, okay, and I'm thinking of things like state-owned enterprises. Everybody looks at TPP and says, well, China couldn't possibly accede to TPP because there are going to be tough rules in there about state-owned enterprises that simply don't fit China's situation. Granted, what you say there is what? Don't try to force China into TPP now. Try to have a continuing dialogue with China on that sort of issue, and let's see how it goes. And in a while, you may be to a point where the issue has changed enough that you can have an accommodation that will either get China into TPP, get TPP melded with RCEP in a free trade agreement of the Asia Pacific, something like that in which you resolve that issue. Third type of issue is one in which you see a changing policy or an effort in a country to, and I'll use the word liberalize, its policy in a certain area. And it is a politically difficult area, but an area in which there's a desire to liberalize, but the pressure of trade negotiations may combine with the domestic imperative to liberalize to bring liberalization. The classic example of that, it seems to me, is the European Common Agricultural Policy, in which the pressure of the Uruguay round agricultural negotiations played a major role, together with the financial pressures of the Butter Lake and all of the other aspects of the CAP, to move Europe toward a different policy. And that's one of the reasons that it seems to me that it is so important for China and the United States, for China and the Western world, or however you want to call it, look at the dichotomy, to have not a, not a completely hard-hitting, let's negotiate solution to these problems now, but a dialogue in which the two countries manage the issues and look toward how they will be resolved, possibly through negotiation, possibly through internal change, possibly through a combination of the two.
Good. Bernard, Shu, and
Beth. Thanks. So it's a very interesting discussion. I just want to pick up on a few points that have been made. So one on the development dimension, least developed countries, etc. My view of this is, you know, bag what you have and move on, because, you know, the world really has changed in that respect as well. And I think the issue that you raised with respect to Vietnam and the TPP is a perfect illustration of how essentially you're pushing on a string if you're trying to do this through Geneva, because, you know, I think that is exactly the illustration, right? So you can say what you like, but if you're not in the process of actually negotiating reciprocal market access, you know, it's not going to be given to you. So I think we really need to focus on what is the economics of a lot of these issues that keep on percolating and coming back in the WTO context through special and differential treatment. And I think there I would argue that the trade facilitation agreement really has been a game changer, in a sense that it really shows a better way of moving forward on these issues. And I think beating your heads collectively against this wall of trying to get better preferential access on a non-reciprocal basis is simply a huge waste of time. And that also applies to the services waiver, right? So I think in principle it's really nice to have the services waiver, but given that you have the capacity, the supply side capacity constraints on this, again, it's very difficult to use. So I think Lou's point also here certainly resonated with me. So I think it would be much more productive to kind of deal with some of the issues that Debbie raised, which again, you know, also when I talk to companies, this comes back again and again. There are a lot of issues which are trade facilitation related, but are not necessarily addressed by the trade facilitation agreement. And I think the big change, and I think the really positive development that has happened, and we can just attribute it, you know, this is part of a Doha round outcome, which I think is very important from a development perspective, is that the trade facilitation agreement in itself is going to help, but it also creates the potential to actually use the institutional mechanisms that will have to be put in place to implement that agreement to actually deal with these other issues, which are frequently much more important than the customs-related stuff, right? So labeling would be an example. The link to product standards would be another example. The link to logistics would be an example, so that you get the services side in there. And I think that's something countries can and should do themselves, right? So this is something you can do unilaterally. And I think the big thing that has changed as a result, again, of the trade facilitation agreement is that the development community now is much more kind of connected to the trading system, right? So you have the World Banks of the world, the regional development banks, now the new, you know, infrastructure bank, all of those institutions and mechanisms are there to actually help deal with these types of issues, which frequently are infrastructural in nature. Yes, there's a policy dimension, but a lot of this also revolves around infrastructure. So I would push much more on that and actually make that part of a post-Bali kind of thinking process in terms of how do you actually facilitate that process of using the mechanisms that have been put in place that are important for development to actually deal with the development issues more effectively and more concretely on the ground. And I would just chalk that up as a big win, right? And I think that really has, in my mind, made a big difference. I would also like to go back then on terms of looking forward to Ambassador Soon's opening remarks this morning, kind of thinking about, and I think this is something we can collectively do and focus on, is how can you put together, and it really struck me, so we have the TISA talks going on, we have the ITA, we have the environmental goods discussion, so how do you bring that back in? Right? And I think there is a potential here to actually, if you are creative, to construct what you call the grand bargain as part of the process, both of concluding Doha, but also then identifying an agenda for how do we move on from where we are now. So I thought that was very, that really struck me as something that could help kind of move this whole beast forward a bit. And I would also like to then pick up on the point that was made, given that we're moving, hopefully, and TISA, of course, is an open question, and we'll discuss that later on, whether that is going to be discriminatory or not. But assuming we are talking about critical mass agreements that are applied on an MFN basis, I think one of the big challenges looking forward, again, post-Bali, is how do you facilitate the process of rulemaking on a plurilateral basis, which is open, right? And I think here we have a problem with the WTO framework, because you can do that in services, because we have an article in the GATS that allows you to make additional commitments, which you can apply on an MFN basis. We don't have that in the GATS. So when it looked like India was going to kill off the trade facilitation agreement, there was a little bit of thinking about, okay, how do you get the TFA into the WTO as a critical mass agreement? And nobody really knew, right? So there were some really contorted arguments being made at the time as to how you might be able to schedule that, which never really made a whole lot of sense to me. So I think that's something to really focus on. So if we go down this route of trying to multilateralize a lot of the things that are happening in plurilateral agreements, there has to be a better mechanism to actually, how do you incorporate that into the WTO? Again, assuming you want to apply that on a non-discriminatory basis. So that, I think, is certainly something for a post-Bali work program to focus on explicitly. Two final remarks, one to add on to Vera's list of how the world kind of has changed. There's a lot of work going on right now in the economics community trying to figure out, has trade peaked, right? So we have peak oil and now we have peak trade. Because, you know, the stylized fact is that trade growth globally has not grown faster than GDP for the last 5 years or so for the world as a whole, right? And the stylized fact, for those of you who have read GATT reports, for those of you who are, I think, number of people around the room are in that category of age. You know, one of the things that the annual report always said, world trade has grown 50% faster than GDP or 100% faster, whatever. So that seems to be, certainly it's over in terms of the last 5-6 years or so. And the big question is this something which is cyclical or is this something which is structural? And I kind of lean towards the arguments that a large part of this is structural. And what that means, and I think, you know, a number of people have made this point, if you look at where people are investing, what they're looking for, they're looking to invest, right? So we're talking much more about an investment story, because if it's mostly going to be much more about domestic demand and domestic absorption as opposed to trade, then that means you want to be in those markets and service those markets through investment. So that, I think, really changes the equation in terms of what firms are looking for and what firms will be looking for. And that really increases the need to actually think about, okay, how do you deal with the investment issue in the WTO, which is not just about FDI, right? It goes into infrastructure, it goes into public-private partnerships, it goes into portfolio capital. But that really is then the next agenda for the WTO. So let me stop there. Thanks. And my last point was going to be, let's forget about agriculture. So just to put something controversial on the table. Because I think, again, in terms of Vera is not going to like this, but it's such an intractable beast, so I think you need to be creative. The US can't do anything much on this. India is becoming, you know, as difficult as the EU used to be. So, I mean, I just don't see a way to square this particular circle. So I leave that to the more creative minds around the table. But I think if we try and deal with agriculture now, we're going to be at this still 10 years from now.
So please, and then Ambassador.
Okay, before making comment, as for the trade having the growing much faster than GDP in the world, until recently, maybe it's because of the global value chain has been, you know, expanding. So some of those intermediate goods trade has been double counted, you know, or the more than double counted. But then the more, you know, recently maybe the investment argument could explain why we are not seeing that much of the faster growth in the trade. I mean, it's just one possible explanation. Going back to what Deborah mentioned about the business. It's not just business, also there was some name that the first thing he mentioned was the push for oil. And who really cares about the push for these days? I mean, in the world. I mean, the political leaders, President Obama and whoever in any country, the leaders' interests are in creating jobs. And what trade is going to get us? can it get us via the, some, you know, the jobs in the Mexico? And also some of those via the, you know, is it going to be a good for our economy? And also, their interest is, as others also already mentioned, investment. I mean, also via the, how can my, I mean, the, my country's business go out overseas market and via the operate just like in the Mexico, in the domestic market. So, in order to achieve those goals, WTO is not the, you know, the ideal place. So I think that's why there's not much excitement about even if we have conclude the VBA. Who's going to be really excited about so that's why I think I fully agree with what Bernard was saying that probably post Bali. The WTO should have some new kind of structure or the framework. The current forum is not going to work with all this dealing with all the new issues or getting us to somewhere that might be exciting. And also, the WTO. I mean, I still think that Tamagotchi was mentioning that WTO is a backbone. So I think the WTO has the role, and we should focus more on that, the role of the backbone of the world trade. And I think that's why one of the issues that we have, like TISA and ITA, EGA, those bilateral that actually get some more attention from the world than the VBA itself. I mean, at least to me. So, those are issues, and maybe we should think more about the future of the next post-Bali
WTO. Good. That's
good. Thank you very much. I think after this intervention, I thought I should have accepted the invitation to make a speech of the post-WTO negotiation. What's the use of WTO? Is WTO still useful? Is there any reason for WTO continue to exist? I think for this foreign businessman, not a single businessman talking about WTO, I think a little bit, I could not understand, because they are the biggest beneficiaries of WTO rules. Without WTO, they could not have developed into what they are now. And all these FTAs, RTAs, they're trying to do better or more liberalized than WTO rules. But the WTO, you cannot disrupt the basis, the very foundation of WTO. I think we must give education to those business people, not to be too short-sighted. You have to look at the bigger picture. I understand that the American Chamber of Commerce, the European Chamber of Commerce are doing a great deal trying to educate their business people to show concern about the environment for their doing business. How they have benefited so much, and now they are not paying any attention to this multilateral process. I think it's a shame. It is a shame. And WTO, I understand the USTR, Michael Froman, is doing a great job trying to negotiate with India to implement trade facilitation. The US is not abandoning WTO. The US is working, on the one hand, on TPP and TTIP, on the other hand, on WTO, on post-Bali program. Without the efforts of Michael Froman, we could not have this current trade facilitation agreement on the table. So that's my understanding. I think if this group will lose faith on WTO, there's hopeless. We have to think of setting another international organization, maybe led by the emerging economies, to replace WTO. I think that would be dangerous, very dangerous. So I think better educate our business people, educate the Congress people, the administrative people. the basic fundamental principles of WTO, transparency, non-discrimination, are so important, trying to be more liberalized. And at the same time, Doha Round was not started by developing countries. It was pushed by European Union, by America. There was strong resistance by India and many developing countries against Doha Round. And later, we were forced to be part of that negotiation. Now they were, after 15 years of negotiation, you try to abandon the whole Doha Round. Why? This Rev 4 and Rev 3 negotiated for 8 years and supported by so many business people and so many USGRs, Bob Zolik, Rob Portman, have put in such energy and time in this negotiation. And finally, they try to ignore the results and try to tackle their own concerns and abandon this development agenda. It's a shame. It's a shame. The world should not work like that. The world has changed. We should work together. Like Professor Cunningham said, we have to work together and take into consideration all the concerns, not only developed countries, but developing, and especially LDCs. If we cannot address LDCs' concerns, if we cannot address developing concerns about agriculture, there's no way. We have no hope. And I think it is our responsibility to try to strengthen WTO. If we cannot do this year, it's hopeless next year. Election year in the US. So we have to seize this opportunity and try and work hard and try to educate our people, educate our leaders, educate our business people, and strengthen further WTO to have a win-win situation. Thank you.
Congratulations, Ambassador. You too. But Tomoshiko, please, the last word.
Thank you very much. I want to have lunch. I feel like I'm the people of Ambassador Son. To be educated. small comments. The first one is about WTO and business. One thing I'm kind of impressed by the conversation with business people is that actually quite a number of business people are coming last 2-3 years to Geneva on ITA. And I just asked a question, since there are so many RTAs, like TPP and TTIP and so forth, why are you coming to Geneva to spend such money to follow the ITA negotiation? And I was very interested, their answer was, okay, FTA is okay, because it's going to be tax or to be zero, but they have to pay the price of pay the burden of certificate of origin in order to enjoy the preferential tariff. They have to give the certificate of origin to prove this is subject to this FTA. But it is a globalized world, in particular the IT products. MFN basis. Zero type on MFN basis have a value to pursue. So I thought is very interesting. And this kind of aspect should be more explored to promote the value of WTO. And the second one is a plurilateral rulemaking. When we are a bit not really sure whether we have a trade facilitation coming out or not. Actually, this is not a statement of the Japanese government against my personal view, but there is some kind of a personal exploration of how to make plurilateral rulemaking on a pan-American basis. And yes, it's services, additional commitments, and the basic telephones, the reference paper, and that's a kind of model. But the question is whether it's not possible to put it in the trading goods part. And when you read the gap again, we thought it's possible. It's not just tariff. There's no limitation of just the tariff of what can be written schedule to the and the GATT, but actually any commitments related to the condition of commerce and schedule. So I think like scheduling of the reference paper type of tools could be possible, and it may be very useful for the future negotiations. And the third is investment. Well, it's a wrong decision to put investment out of the package of the DDA. It was done by the Ambassador Oshima when he was chairman of the General Council. And in the July package, it's 2004. And what I appreciate him is not the decision itself, but actually the neutrality of his chairmanship, because this was made against the interest of Japanese interest, but under the chairman Oshima. Because there's so much resistance from the developing countries, so the only to save the trade facilitation, he has to have a deal with the abandon of others, including investment. But it's not just investment negotiation, but all activities with investment actually put out of the FTP. That was the decision in 2004. But I think that's if there's another consensus to come back to the activities of investment, or maybe possibly competition may be useful. And the last point is about development. This really my professor view, but it's, I was wonder, I agree that in the era of global value chain, I think it's more important is about supply capacity of goods or services. And what is the key, how to participate in the global value chain as an exporter, is how to really invite investment. So how to create a better environment for investment. My question is, in order for the developing countries really get the benefit of trade, is S&D really work? I think we have to really look at those issues. I think it should be have an exercise. What's the sort of real example of S&D really worked for the development of trade, for the development of developing countries? And actually, on the contrary, there are a lot of successful examples making commitments or other ways of increasing, enhancing the investment climate, of course including infrastructure and institutional reforms. This, acceding to WTO maybe is one of them. This kind of really worked to inviting investment. It's not really the S&D that worked for inviting investment or increased supply capacities. I think it's perhaps the people should look at more of a practical way, also best way for really development. So this is my thought. Thank you.
Two minutes, 1 minute and a half to Mr.
Fritos. Thank you, Jay. I really appreciate it. Just to react to what Bernard has said, if I go without answering him, I will be, losing my sleep. As we all appreciate, LDCs are also changing their stance in view of what is happening in the world. We registered the trade facilitation in 1995. We have now agreed to that. The problem with the LDCs is that we are having to develop at a time which are very challenging and which the developed countries didn't have to face. We know all the, the child labor in the factories and the environmental pollution that accompany the development of the currently developed countries. But now we are having to, face this. So one, we have to also appreciate that the difficulties that the newly developing countries like ours are facing, which the developed countries didn't face when they were developing in the 19th century and early 20th century. With regard to the non-reciprocity, I think non-reciprocity should not be taken or perceived as a gift. When we have preferential market access, zero tariff, or flexible rules of origin, and our exports go up, and everyone recognizes that also enhances our capacity to import. And we are the major markets of the developed countries. So it's not just that it's a gift, it's also because the developed countries recognize that if S&D is given, market access is given, we have more purchasing power, more job creation, more imports, and we are more of a market for the developed countries. I think that enlightened self-interest is working when the developed countries give us S&D. So I do think that that non-reciprocity, which is enshrined in the WTO, is a gift, but it is enlightened self-interest of the developed countries that trade is an engine of growth, and if the agencies have higher trade, then it becomes also a bigger market for the developed countries. I think that is what is in their mind also. The third is that, you know, with Vietnam and Bangladesh, the problem is that, you know, the U.S. Tariffs, import tariffs is 15% on the ready-made garments. If it was 2%, 3%, the average tariff rate of U.S., then it will have a problem. For example, last year, you know, the import duties on Bangladesh's export to the U.S. was $800 million. You know, four times the aid that we received from the U.S. So that is the problem. And the African LDCs also get zero tariff. So it is also not American. So that's where the problem is. Obviously, we understand that at some point of time we will have to enhance our labor standards, our copyright, IPR regimes, etc. But then, as I say, we need also support in order to enhance our capacity. So I think that the debate has to be more broader and does not trade, but trade, technical assistance, financial assistance, so that we can all grow together. Thank you.
Good. So, I think we have ready for the lunch.
Amen.
Can we be volunteers here? Can we be?
You can leave that back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's walk to the back.
Okay.
On campus.
Yes. One of those two will be back on laptop. I'll be back.